Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interest in every way. Now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And our guest today is a household word in this area, isn't he, Ed?
Yes, he's a nationally known sportscaster who was the voice of the Cleveland Browns, the Cleveland Indians, the Boston Red Sox, and now with the Cincinnati Reds. Dick, meet Ken Coleman.
It's a delight to have you here. Ken, I learned that you were born in Hartford. Is that true?
That's absolutely right, Dick. And I don't want to, get off on the bad foot here, but I did leave when I was 5 months old, and I'd like to make it clear it wasn't my decision.
I'm glad that you clarified that. Ken, you've written a book which perhaps fills a void that has needed to be filled for as long as radio broadcasters have been around. The book is called So You Want to Be a Sportscaster, published, incidentally, by Hawthorne Books. I know a lot of people are going to want to go out and buy that book because there are a lot of people who want to be sportscasters who don't know where to begin. That's the real reason you wrote the book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Over the years that I've been covering major league sports, both in baseball and in football, I discovered that I was getting mail from people and talking with a lot of my contemporaries. They also were getting mail, particularly from young people, but not always young people, who were interested in getting into sports announcing. And you really could not answer them in 3 pages or a dozen pages, Dick. You had to, you just simply could not do it. And so the idea came to mind that, I'll sit down and write one. So the book has 16 chapters in it. I know it is the only book that has ever been written by a person who makes his living at the business. And I try to cover all phases of it. It is a textbook, but I also tried to write it for the layman, based a lot on my own experiences, but including such things as the spotting boards that a fellow uses in doing a football game and the scoring methods in doing baseball, the little charts you might use in doing a basketball game, and all of the, other little inside things that we would know about, but the average person might not. And that includes a chapter on the art of interviewing, as a matter of fact. And it was fun to do. I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. And I have found in talking with the fellows around the league, they kind of kid me because they say, well, you took me off the hook, Coleman, because now when people write to me, I just say, well, go get his book, But it is not a big-selling book and is not intended to be. It has now come out in paperback, but it's been a slow and steady sale. And I also might add, I think it very possibly is the only clean book written about sports in the last 5 years. I don't know.
That's rather refreshing to know. Ken, when you started out in this business, were you intent upon becoming a sportscaster, or did that happen accidentally?
No, I wanted to be a sports announcer, Dick, since I was in the eighth grade, oddly enough. I grew up in North Quincy, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston. It's only 8 miles from Fenway Park. And as a boy, I was an athlete, particularly a baseball player. And I had an accident occur when I was in the eighth grade, and I lost the sight in my left eye, and knew that any possibilities of my going further were practically nil. Not that I would have made it even if I'd been fine, but It was at that point, I would say, and also the fact that my brother had been in vaudeville, and so you might say in a form of show business, which when you come right down to it, I think broadcasting is. We are journalists, I hope, in sports broadcasting, but also there is that difference between a broadcaster and, say, a newspaper reporter, because we're dealing with different methods of communication, in my opinion.
Well, that's interesting. I was just wondering if you could just tell us how you got started, you know, your first radio station that you worked for, and maybe how you actually evolved into becoming the announcer for the Cleveland Browns, you know, the various steps that you went through to do that.
Well, Ed, I was working, I went to Curry College in Boston for a year, and a fellow named Art King had a program on WEEI called the Veterans Job Center of the Air, and he would pick announcers from Curry to come over and tell about these various jobs. Well, there happened to be a job open in Rutland, Vermont, and I was fortunate enough to get the job, which, like in all small radio stations, included everything from news to record shows and sports. I did the Rutland Royals of the Northern League at that time. In fact, Johnny Antonelli was a pitcher on our team. Robin Roberts was a pitcher for the Montpelier team up there. It was a good league. And so I started in Rutland, and I went to Quincy, which is my hometown, and then I went up to Worcester, Mass., and after 5 years was fortunate enough to have an opportunity come up with the Browns in Cleveland, and I went out there.
Just a regular audition, or they hear you on the air, or how did you happen to...
No, I had been talking with a man named Tom McMahon, who was with NW Air, which was on for a large... the sponsor or the agency for a large refining company that used to sponsor most sports in the East. And Tom recommended me for the job. Lindsey Nelson was one of the other people who was... a candidate for the job in that season, I know, and Lindsey went on to, as they say, bigger and better things. But I was fortunate enough to get the job, and strangely enough, without benefit of a tape as such, that is to say, a play-by-play tape. I sent them a disc. We had discs in those days.
Yes, I remember.
So my letter of application was on a record, because I knew they wanted to have some idea of the sound. And that's the way I sent my letter of application in. Then I went out to Cleveland, and I met with the people. And from a 250-watt radio station in Worcester in 1 year, I was just fortunate. I think this is so true in this business, the matter of being in the right place at the right time, because I know a lot of very capable broadcasters working in small radio stations who just never really get the opportunity.
Yeah, it is very, very true.
Speaking, if I may, for just a second, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but in the 9 years that I was doing the Red Sox ball games, I might add that, you know, we our flagship station was in Boston, but I have to say that WTIC was a second flagship station, because I was getting mail from down in the Carolinas and down around Washington, D.C., and through there, and all of those folks were picking it up on WTIC. You have a great signal, don't you, going out?
As a matter of fact, we do. There is a club, you know. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there is a club located in New York made up of former New Englanders who were dyed-in-the-wool Red Sox fans.
I have had occasion to speak to them.
Have you?
Yes.
And they've got antennas on the roofs of apartment houses in Brooklyn and in New Jersey and places all over the map in that area to pick up WTIC signals so they can keep in touch with the Red Sox.
That's right. So. Indeed, they do. Right.
Well, at any rate, we're talking about when? The early 1950s with the Browns?
1952 was the year that I started. Otto Graham, who, of course, is right here in the state of Connecticut at the Coast Guard Academy, was the quarterback at that time with the Browns and stayed on through the 1955 season. In fact, Otto did a year of color commentary with me in 1956. And I might add that I think that Otto Graham was the best quarterback I've ever seen.
Were you on a sort of a regional network with the Browns at the time?
Well, at that time, it was kind of interesting, Dick. We had the first 2 years I did radio, we had a 50-station, 51, 52-station network. Then I went to the television side, and for the first year we were with the old Dumont Network, and then we went on our own. And a man in Cleveland by the name of Paul Warren formed a network that was the largest network of its kind in the country, and we were in like 125 markets because, for example, there was no professional football then in Dallas or St. Louis and a number of other cities, and we went all over the West. We even came into New England. We had a good following here in the New England area with those Browns teams, and so we really had a very large network. And then in the last, I would guess, 7 or 8 years that I was involved with the Browns, CBS came in, and we did have our own regional network, which was mostly Ohio, upstate New York, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, you know, in through that Midwestern area.
I'm sure, Ken, that the people ask you, you know, by whom were you influenced when you got into this business? We go back to the eighth grade. Now, you were listening to people on the air. There was no television in those days, and you were listening to people like Bill Stern and Ted Husing and maybe even McNamee, for that matter. I don't know. I don't remember him myself.
No,
I don't think you do either.
No.
But was there any one voice that particularly influenced you?
Well, I think that any of us, and I'm not sure that I had this feeling as a youngster. I do remember Fred Hoy, but not well. Jim Britt was the first one I remembered in Boston, and Jim, as a matter of fact, I worked with Jim in Cleveland for 2 seasons as his second man on Cleveland baseball. But I would listen to, I could pick up in the Boston area. We got the Yankee broadcast and the Dodger broadcast, so I could hear Mel Allen, who of course lives here in Stamford now, and Red Barber and other broadcasters. And I think that anybody who is aspiring to get into the business listens a little differently than just the fan who wants the information, because you have a tendency to listen to pick out some of the good things that you think a fellow is doing and perhaps to say, well, I don't want to do this kind of thing that, you know, you might think is not good that the fellow does. But I can't say that there was any one person, no, that I, you know, really hung on to. I think that there are some announcers who almost impersonate other broadcasters because they've heard them so often. But that was not the case. I
listened
to a lot of...
You had your own style all the way.
Yes, right, Ed. Yes. Right.
Let's dip back into your collection, Ed, because I do want to, through the use of our conversation today, trace the development of sports announcing. And perhaps we might start off with Ted Husing.
Yes, I thought he was the best. He used to do the Notre Dame games when I was a kid, and he really, I don't know, he had a way of charming you as a listener. So
he was one, really a great broadcaster, no question.
And I thought he may have been one of the people who inspired you, because he did, those games were all over the country, presumably the Notre Dame games. But this is one I believe he was doing at a track meet. And it's unfortunately a very short excerpt, but it's we don't have much that survived his career, unfortunately. This is just one of the few that did turn up.
Well, one word just before we do here, Ted. You know, the first chapter of the book is sort of the history of sports broadcasters, including the pioneers, and Husing's mentioned in it, and a number of other, like a man named Arlen was the first man, Harold Arlen, the first man to do a baseball game. And these were the pioneers. And there was nobody, you know, that they could listen to, and they just had to go and decide on how to do it. And I think they deserve a tremendous amount of credit for the imagination that they used in getting it done.
Ted Husing.
Here he is into the motion. There's the windup. Here's the pitch. It's a slow curve low, and the Babe swings. It's a long one going out toward right center. Stengel's backing up against the wall. He can't get it. It's in there. Another home run for the Bambino. So the Babe hits his second homer of the day.
The voice of Ted Husing, which takes a lot of people back a good many, many years. Our guest is Ken Coleman here on the Golden Age of Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
If your car has just about been making it through the winter, then drive into spring with a new car. Dealers are offering some great buys right now on remaining 1976 models, as well as new, more economical 77s. Visit one of the offices of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or their Cromwell Savings Bank division. and ask them to help map out one of their convenient auto loans for you. They'll help you purchase that new car quickly and easily, and you'll get low-cost bank interest rates, too. At both Farmers and Mechanics and Cromwell Savings, you can count on friendly and accommodating service. So check into an automobile loan soon and drive into spring with that new car. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings has two. One at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, or the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Members FDIC. And now back to Dick Bertel.
Ken Coleman is our guest, the voice of the Cincinnati Reds for 9 years, the voice of the Boston Red Sox in this area, and we could go on, the voice of the Cleveland Browns and so on. Ken is also the author of a new book called So You Want to Be a Sportscaster. If you'd like to get into the field and you want to read about a professional who did it and who can tell you how to do it, I suggest you get a copy of this book. Ken, when did you join? That must have been a very exciting moment for you when you joined the Red Sox, because you had grown up in the area. You said that you were, what, 8 miles from Fenway Park, something like that?
That's right, Dick. I used to go in and sit in the bleachers and watch them all the time as a youngster. And in 1966, Kurt Gowdy left Boston to go with NBC, and the job opened up, and I came to Boston that year, and we finished a half a game out of 10th place in 1966, and I felt that that was really, in retrospect, very good because of the fact that in 67 we won the pennant, and that made that season much more meaningful after having struggled through, you know, the crowd. The biggest thing we had to talk about in 66 was Jose Tartable taking a lead off first base. You know, that was about it. But and it was really funny, and I think it's an indication of how important it is to a broadcaster to be around a team that is really a good team. And I've been very lucky in that respect. And what I'm getting at is this. Very often, after the Red Sox won it in 67, I had a chance then to do a World Series, even though prior to that I had done seven NFL championship games on the network. But, you know, this was a very big thing. And I came down to Connecticut to do the Harvard-Yale game at New Haven, and Charlie Loftus was the sports information director at Yale. And Charlie and I were good friends. And he said to me, you know, Coleman, he said, in 1966, he said, last year, I figured you probably had about three bartenders pushing the beer that you're trying to sell, and maybe three or four gasoline dealers who were pushing the gas you were trying to sell in the state of Connecticut. That was your listenership. But in 67, you had the whole state wrapped up, which is just another way of saying that the Red Sox captured the imagination of New England sports fans in 1967, and, of course, everybody got the pennant fever, and it was really a very most exciting couple of months I spent in my broadcasting life.
Yeah, I would think that would be. As you indicated, everybody was a Red Sox fan, no matter what team you rooted for in 1967. What... Ken, I'm sure you're asked these questions all the time, but they're always fun. What do you remember is happening that might have been difficult for you, unusual, amusing? Were you ever called upon to ad lib for a half hour or an hour because a game was held up? What stands out in your mind?
Well, in terms of the delays that we had, Dick, rain delays, a lot of people said, well, gee, that must have been very difficult, and... frankly, that wasn't. That was fun for me, and the reason it was fun was because I think it gave me an opportunity to have the chance to come across as just a human being and to talk about a lot of things that I had on my mind. And, of course, Johnny Pesky was working with me, and John was excellent in rain delays. And we'd have other guests on who were very good, and I found it challenging but very interesting to do. In terms of mistakes, you know, you naturally, I guess human nature being what it is, you do remember them probably more than the fan does, and sometimes they can be you know, embarrassing, silly things. Like I was doing a game one night in Kansas City with Cleveland, and Rocky Colavito was going back after a fly ball, and I was describing it, and, you know, I meant to say, there goes Rocky back against the wall, and the way it came out was, there goes Wally back against the rock. And so, you know, you just don't know.
That's a real good one. Well, what stands out in your mind in that pennant drive, you know, in 67? It must have been, you say, a fantastic year, but what are some of the things that you recall about that season that's still, you know, very sharply defined in your memory?
The 10-game winning streak, we came back from Cleveland. At the conclusion of it, there were about 10,000 people at Logan Airport. In fact, we almost had a riot there. The bus was almost tipped over to getting us into the terminal. The last two games of the season, when Yastrzemski went 7-for-8, the morning of the last game, Carl had all of his relatives in, and he and his wife Carol stayed at the Colonial Country Club in Linfield just so that they could have peace and quiet. And on the morning of the last game, he went out and walked 18 holes around that golf course. That's how charged up he was. And, of course, the great performance of Jim Lonborg and being in the clubhouse when Lonborg and company came in to the into the dressing room knowing that they had won. And then, of course, we had to sit in the dressing room and wait to see how the Tigers made out against the California Angels. Dick McAuliffe has always been a very dear friend of mine, and we're always grateful that Dick hit into the double play that ended it. Just another contribution from the state of Connecticut. But Dick did, and in that clubhouse went crazy just about that time because the Red Sox had won the pennant.
Well, almost reminiscent of the 51 with the Giants, you know, that was another, probably a greatest moment in baseball, but this had to come pretty close, a 67 drive, I would think.
I did a show called Where Are They Now, and I used the description that I think you have coming up here of Russ Hodges, but I talked with Bobby Thompson when I was doing that show. Bobby Thompson works for a paper company in Waukesha, New Jersey, and he was recalling that incident. I said, what do you remember about it? And he said, the pressure was taken off me a little bit. But he said the reason it was taken off was because Whitey Lockman slid into third base and broke his ankle, and there was a delay. And as they were taking care of Whitey, then Bobby started to walk back down toward the plate. And I don't think this was ever really publicized very much. DeRocher came along. He put his arm around Bobby, and he said, if you ever hit one, do it now.
The shot heard around the world.
Yes, sir.
Let's listen to Russ Hodges as he describes that memorable event.
Bobby Thompson up there swinging. He's had 2 out of 3, a single and a double, and Billy Cox is playing him right on the third base line. One out, last of the ninth, flag of pitches. Bobby Thompson takes a strike call on the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads it 4-2. Hartung down the line at third, not taking any chances. Lockton without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Cracker throws. There's a long strike! It's going to be, I believe! The Giants run the pellet! 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stand. The Giants run the pellet, and they're going crazy! They're going crazy! Hey-ho! In a line drive into the lower deck of the left field stand, and the great race is going crazy. The Giants, by a score of the center winner, the Giants won it by a score of 5-4, and they're picking Bobby Thompson up and carrying him off the field.
Russ Hodges back in 1951 as the Giants win the pennant, as Russ kept screaming into that microphone. Well, the Red Sox won the pennant in 1967, and there must have been some exciting moments for you. I'm building up, Ken, to the fact that we're going to hear you in action.
that series.
Well, I think that what we do have is a man in Evansville, Indiana, by the name of John Miley. And John is probably got the biggest collection of sports play-by-play tapes of anybody in the country. And I was on a program in Boston recently, and John was on it at the same time. And in fact, I had heard him a couple of nights previously, and I called him up because I had done the 67 series, and I was looking for the radio tapes of the series, the games in St. Louis I did on radio, the games in Boston on television. And John has arranged to send them to me. So the game that that I have, I think, at the moment is Game 5 with Jim Lonborg pitching in the ninth inning, as I remember it.
Ken Coleman in action.
This is Ken Coleman with Pee Wee Reese in St. Louis. It's the ninth inning. Ron Willis is pitching now for St. Louis. Led the Red Sox in stolen bases. Here's the pitch to him. Lines went down. The left field line might be foul. It isn't. It's a fair ball. Scott is around second. He's digging for third. Smith into second. Runners at second and third, and nobody out on the Boston ninth inning. Reggie Smith, a left-handed batter, going to the opposite field. Lines one to left for a double, moving Scott around to third. And the Red Sox in the ninth have runners at second and third with nobody out. And the batter is Rico Petrocelli. The Red Sox have the bases loaded with nobody out in the ninth. The count is ball one to Elston Howard. And Jack LaMave has just come in to do the pitching for the Cardinals. Abe into the windup. And the pitch. There's a fly ball into short right field. Scott tags up. It is a base hit. Here comes Scott home. He is safe. Smith is coming. He is safe. And over to third base is Petrocelli. Boston leads 3-0. A pop fly down the right field line. Maris made a great fly and then a very hard throw. And Smith was right behind Scott, who scored first. And the ball, as it came into McCarver, was apparently just momentarily bobbled. And Smith had a chance to get in with the third Boston run. And the batter will be Maris. Maris had the last St. Louis hit in the fourth. And then Lonborg got, let's see, 2, 3, 5, 8, 11, 12 in a row before Javier reached on an error. Then got the last four men. And here's Maris. 1-for-3 for Rogers. Two out. The Cardinal ninth. Boston ahead. 3-0. The pitch is in there for a strike call. The outfield playing toward right for Boston. Lonborg into the windup. Big right-hander throws. Fly ball hits deep into right field. Going back to the wall is Carnival. He leads. It's gone for a home run. With two men out in the ninth, Roger Maris has hit a home run over the fence in right field, about 345 feet away, and the score is 3-1 Boston.
Oh, I'm looking forward to the baseball season. I tell you, it's great just to hear it described. Our guest is Ken Coleman here on the Golden Age of Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
Spring is officially here. If 1977 is the year that you plan some improvements to your home or property, stop in soon and chat with the folks at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or their Cromwell Savings Bank division. Perhaps that much-needed family room is tops on your priority list. Maybe it's a dormer and the enlarging of those upstairs bedrooms you've been contemplating, or a new patio or driveway. Whatever the reason, get complete information on a home improvement loan now. You'll find Cromwell Savings Bank located at the corner of Main and West Streets and the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell, with convenient Saturday hours, 9 to noon. And Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. With the exception of the Middletown office on Main Street, they're also open Saturdays from 9 to noon. Visit them soon. Let them show you how a home improvement loan can help you. Members FDIC and Equal Housing Lenders. Once again, Dick Bertel.
Ken Coleman, the voice of the Cincinnati Reds, of course the voice for 9 years of the Boston Red Sox, and author of the new book, So You Want to Be a Sportscaster, published by Hawthorne Books, our guest today here on the Golden Age of Radio. When you were involved with the Red Sox, you were also chairman of the Jimmy Fund, weren't you? That took you around New England.
Well, yes, Dick. In fact, I'm pleased to tell you that I still am the...
I didn't realize that.
Yes, yes. I have continued my relationship with the Jimmy Fund. It kind of went, you know, with the job of being the play-by-play announcer for the Red Sox, but I, for personal reasons, got very much involved in it, and I have done, you know, just because it's something that's very meaningful to me, I have continued my close association with it, and in fact, there are a number of people right here in the state of Connecticut who have done just a tremendous work for the Jimmy Fund, and we're most grateful for it. That's obviously just a great cause.
Well, when you think of the Jimmy Fund, one name comes out, Ted Williams, you know, the greatest guy to ever live, for my money, and... Have you still, do you work with him, or is he still active in that?
Very much
area?
So. Ted, of course, is a very private man, and he always, in the years that he was involved in it, much of what he did was directly involved with the youngsters themselves that were in the Jimmy Fund Hospital. He was in there to see them. And when he is in Boston, he still does this, and he also, of course, makes himself available when he can for different appearances for the fund itself.
He's still the greatest Red Soxer of all time, isn't he, you think, in retrospect?
I have to say that as a boy growing up, you know, if you went in to see the Red Sox play and they were down 12-1 in the eighth inning and you knew that Williams was going to bat in the last of the eighth, you stayed. That's the way he was. I think that pretty well sums it up.
I think so. Well, you know, as a sportscaster, you are employed by the team. You work for the Reds now, don't you?
No, I work for, in this instance, the television station that does the Reds games.
Does it work both ways?
It does work both ways. For example, Ned Martin and Jim Woods in Boston work for the radio station. Dick Stockton and Ken Harrelson work for the television station. The Yankee broadcasters and the Met broadcasters work directly for the teams. And it varies from city to city, market to market, depending on what the well, I don't know what the reasons for it is are, but it just seems to be that some cities prefer to have it that the announcers now the Reds radio broadcasting crew, for example, works directly for the club, and the Reds indeed operate their own network. The station is just the catalyst for putting on the games. The Reds sell their own time and the whole thing. That's their method of operation. So it does vary, Dick, from city to city.
Do you, in a sense, live with the team? Are you a part of it? Are you
yes.
one of the members?
Yes, you. I am. And I think this is one of the things about being, let's say, a regional broadcaster as opposed to a national broadcaster. Now, when I was doing the Browns games, I did a lot of games that were seen nationally on CBS television, coast to coast, and I knew that it was my obligation to try to be as objective as I could be. And yet, I'm sure that the emotion, even if it's in the sound, comes through somehow or other, because the fact is that you get to know the people, and if you're human, you know the players and their wives and their children, and you go on a road trip with a team, and if they win 8, 9 out of 10, everybody's happy, everybody's excited, everybody's having a good time, and if they lose 9 out of 10, it's like a morgue, and it's just the feeling that goes with it, and so you know the matter of complete objectivity is in the minds of the beholder, I guess.
Well, really, do fans expect complete objectivity today? Do you demand it of yourself?
Well, again, I think on the case of the regional broadcaster, Johnny Most is a perfect example. There's nobody who has any question in their minds about who John is for. John is for the Celtics, and yet... the thing that I feel about Johnny is the fact that he also is a very fine broadcaster, because he reports what's happening out there on the court, regardless of what his emotions may be, and I think he does give credit on both sides, not always with the officials, but on both sides of the fence, and I like that, and I think most fans do. I don't object to that.
All right, now you indicated that you were tied in emotionally with players with their families and so on. Now, in 1975, the Reds and the Red Sox are coming to an inevitable clash. Where were your emotions?
Well, I'll tell you, they were mixed. They were really mixed. And let me just, if I have a moment, a little interesting anecdote. I was doing a pregame show and two postgame shows for a Boston station. The pregame show was called Reds Report, and I was interviewing Sparky and Pete and Johnny Bench and the different fellows on the Reds team. And then I had these two postgame shows, one of which I did with Pee Wee Reese. So we got to game six. And that, of course, might have been the most exciting game in the history of Major League Baseball. And in the ninth inning, Dick, I went to a payphone back of the press box at Fenway Park, called the station, gave them my number. They called me back because it's not too good to go on the air doing a broadcast and have them say, put in 10 more cents, please, right? You know? So I'm on the payphone, and from the ninth inning to the 12th inning, I was listening over the payphone and never saw a thing. I didn't see the catch that Evans made on Morgan. I didn't see, of course, Carlton Fisk's home run. I missed it all. So the next night, I said to my wife, I said, well, I'm going to stay home and let the television cameras do the work, and I'm going to watch it here at home. And to be very honest with you, I did have very mixed emotions because I had a lot of friends on both sides of the field. And if it could have ended in a tie, I would have been delighted.
It very nearly did. As close to ties as ever going to get in a World
right.
Series.
I guess so. Well, you know, we really ought to get back to your collection, Ed, of sports events and sportscasters. And you've written about Bill Stern, I'm sure, in the book.
Yes, Bill is one of the people that is mentioned briefly in the book, although I do have one chapter. It's called Famous Announcers and How They Got That Way. Well, of course, Bill, of course, having passed on, is not in that chapter, but Bill is in the chapter at the beginning about, you know, the history of broadcasting.
Well, of course, he had a national show on the network, and it was called the Colgate-Palmolive Sports Newsreel, I believe. And he would say in the beginning, it could be fact or fiction or legend. And he would give you these stories, and you never knew whether they were true or not. He did them so cleverly that you could be right or it could be wrong. And I thought we'd do one of those tonight and let the audience judge for themselves whether this really did happen to the people he's talking about.
Bill Stern.
C-O-L-G-A-T-E, Colgate presents Bill Stern.
With the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel.
Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, is on the air. Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, with stories rare. Take his advice and you look keen, you'll get a shave that's smooth and clean. You'll be a Colgate brushless fan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bill Stern bringing you the 353rd edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel, featuring strange and fantastic stories. Some legends, others mere hearsay. But also interesting, we'd like to pass them along to you. Our guest tonight, in person, is one of America's most famous singing stars, Dinah Shore. But before we bring you Dinah Shore, let's begin with Reel One, Profile of Sports Switches. One of the greatest sports stories of all time is the amazing story of Ellsworth Vines. Ellsworth Vines was America's national tennis champion back in 1931. And he won the tennis championship of the United States again in 1932. And then at the very height of his fame, even though he was the tennis champion of the United States, Ellsworth Vines stopped playing tennis and took up golf. Last week in Chicago, at America's biggest golf tournament, this same Ellsworth Vines, who was once America's tennis champion, came within one stroke of winning America's biggest golf tournament. Today, Ellsworth Vines is considered one of the greatest golf players in the world. Just as 15 years ago, he was the greatest tennis player in the world. But speaking of great champions who have switched from one sport to another, let me tell you the amazing story of Frank White. When Frank White was 60 years old, he won the golf championship of the state of Utah. That was 10 years ago. The years passed by after that, and he was forgotten. Until recently, Frank White came back to the sport headlines. For once again, he became a state champion. You see, last week, Frank White won the championship of the state of Utah in tennis. That's the story of a man who won the golf championship of the state of Utah at 60 and the tennis championship of the state of Utah at 70. But perhaps the strangest story of all in sports switches is the story of a man who lived many, many years ago. This man lived in Italy. His name was Bernardine, and he was Italy's champion runner. He could run faster than any other man in Italy. Until one day, right at the very height of his fame, this great runner named Bernardine gave up running, and he invented a new sport. A new sport that spread all over the world. That's the story of a man named Bernardine, who lived in Italy many years ago, and who was Italy's champion runner until he gave up running to invent a new sport. Today, he's not remembered because he did invent a new sport, and yet he can never be forgotten. For you see, while he was alive, Bernardine was a religious priest, and after he died, the church immortalized his memory by making him a saint. Millions of churchgoers today say prayers in his memory, for he's now known as Saint Bernardine. However, few people remember that Saint Bernardine once invented a sport, and yet, strange as it seems, this sport that was invented by this kindly priest who became a saint was the roughest of all sports, for he invented boxing. Portrait of the church's immortal Saint Bernardine. Reel 2. Portrait of history. This is the story of a prize fighter. Oh, he wasn't a professional prize fighter. He was a great amateur boxer. His first name was Robert, and he lived many years ago. Dusty old record books contain no reference to Robert's boxing ability, and yet even after he was too old to go on boxing, he loved to watch boxing matches, and because he did, there's a great story to tell. Robert lived in Washington, D.C., and almost every day you could find Robert sitting in some gymnasium watching the prize fighters and training for their coming boxing bouts. One day, as usual, Robert was seated in a gymnasium when he was told that a friend of his was leaving that day on a train trip and that this friend wanted to see Robert before he left. Immediately, Robert left the gymnasium where he was watching the boxers, and Robert hurried down to the railroad station to say goodbye to his friend. However, when Robert arrived at the railroad station, Robert saw a sight that he was never to forget. For as Robert arrived at the railroad station, there was great excitement. And then in the midst of this excitement, Robert saw some men. Saw them carrying away the body of his friend. The friend that he had come to say goodbye to. His friend had just been shot dead. Assassinated. For you see, Robert's friend was the President of the United States. President Garfield. The years passed by after that. And Robert might have forgotten the assassination of President Garfield, but for something that happened 20 years later. But 20 years later, Robert was in another city attending another boxing bout when he received word that another friend of his was due to arrive at the railroad station in just a few moments. Quickly, Robert left the fight arena, hurried to the other railroad station to greet his other friend. However, just as Robert arrived at that railroad station, he saw that there was great excitement there. And in the midst of this excitement, Robert saw some men, saw them carrying away the body of the friend that he had come to meet. History had repeated itself. For like his first friend, this friend of Robert's had also been shot dead in a railroad station, assassinated. For this friend of Robert's was also a president of the United States, President McKinley. Twice in 20 years, Robert had arrived at a railroad station in time to see a president of the United States assassinated. But even this is not as strange as something that happened to Robert when he was but a boy. For one night during his youth, Robert had been attending a boxing bout, and he'd arrived home a bit late, only to find out that his father and mother had already gone out. They'd gone to the theater to see a show. For a moment, Robert hesitated, and then he decided to join his father and mother at the theater. However, just as Robert arrived at that theater, he saw that there was great excitement there, and in the midst of this excitement, Robert saw some men carrying away the body of his father. His father had been assassinated. For you see, Robert's full name was Robert Lincoln, and his father was Abraham Lincoln. And that's the story of Robert Lincoln. Only three times in the history of this country has a president of the United States been assassinated, and yet a president's son, Robert Lincoln, was on the scene of each of these assassinations a moment after they took place. He arrived immediately after President Garfield was assassinated. He was there immediately after President McKinley was killed, and he arrived just after his own father, Abraham Lincoln, was shot. And the only reason he wasn't there when each president was assassinated was because in each case, Robert was at a boxing bout. But wait a minute. There's an incredible ending to this story. An ending that was published in the Reader's Digest, and here it is. Robert Lincoln, who was on the scene of all three of these assassinations, including the murder of his own father, was years later standing on a railroad station platform when he saw a man fall in front of an oncoming train. Quickly, Robert Lincoln jumped down onto the railroad tracks and pulled that man to safety. Ironically enough, this man whose life Robert Lincoln saved was the son of the man who had murdered Robert's father. Portrait of History. Reel 3. Colgate's camera close-up of Dinah Shore. Dinah Shore is right now starring on Broadway at New York's famous Paramount Theater. But Dinah Shore needs no introduction, for she's America's most famous girl singer. Now, to bring her to you in person, this is Bill Stern switching you from where I'm standing in NBC to backstage at the Paramount Theater in New York City, where the next voice you hear will be Miss Dinah Shore.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's fun for me, a singer, to be able to appear on a sports program, especially with you, Bill. You know, when I was a teenager living in Nashville, I went in for sports as much as I could, but there were times when it wasn't easy. You see, my father was always a little afraid I'd be hurt. He seemed to believe that if I went horseback riding, I'd fall off, or if I went fishing, I'd fall in, or if I went skating, I'd fall down. But when I got to be a big girl, he gave me permission to try out for varsity sports. I did succeed in making the swimming and fencing teams, but he was greatly relieved when I became a cheerleader. Can you imagine what would have happened if I'd missed on a somersault? Speaking of somersaults, Bill, here's an incident I recall which may cause someone listening to do a little somersault. Some years ago, I had a rather interesting experience with a sports expert. It happened while I was still in college, and this man, very well known on the radio, came down home, and I pulled all the strings I could and finally managed to get to see him. And when I did, I sang for him. And then I told him I wanted to quit school and try to make singing my career, and I asked him for advice. And he told me to finish college and then to find another college to go to after that one because singing was not for me. And the boy who gave me that advice was Bill Stern. How are you, Bill? This is Dinah Shore backstage at the Paramount Theater, returning you to Bill Stern in New York.
I remember very well, Dinah, and my face is still very red. Thanks so much. Good luck and good night, Dinah Shore. And that's the 3-0 mark for tonight. Next Friday night, we'll be back same time, same stations, with another edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel. Our guest next Friday evening will be the lovely 20th Century Fox movie star, Miss Vivian Blaine. So be sure and be with us next Friday night, same time, same stations, when we greet you with our special guest, the famous star, Vivian Blaine. See you then. Until then, I'll be seeing you on the screen in the News of the Day newsreel at your favorite Lowe's or Associated Theaters. Now, until next Friday night at this very same time, this is Bill Stern for Colgate Shave Cream wishing you all a good night.
Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, is on his way. Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, had lots to say. He told you tales of sports heroes, the inside dope he really knows. So listen in next Friday night.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Oh, I remember those programs. They were on Friday nights. Do you remember those by any chance, Ken?
Yes, I do. And when Ed mentioned about the fact or fiction, I think some of Bill's play-by-play, from all I've been told, might have been fact or fiction. I know of a couple of games that he did where other older fellows in the business who knew Bill well, in fact, a couple who worked with him behind the scenes, you know, he had a great facility for lateraling the ball all of a sudden.
Yep.
If somebody suddenly had it that wasn't supposed to, you know. I think those things have changed somewhat in the business. I really do. I think that... Bill, however, I can remember the Notre Dame-SMU game like it was yesterday. He could really tell a story, and let's face it, in radio play-by-play, that is a very big part of it, I think. Radio and television, as I try to point out in this book, are two completely different mediums, and I think this is what... people have got to keep in mind when they're in the business. In television, the picture tells the story, and you just put captions on the picture. And the announcer that continually—it's one of the reasons I've always made it a policy as a matter of ethics, not to say anything about any other individual in my business because it's a tough business and I don't believe in doing it. But I have to say that I do think that the matter of putting three men in a booth is bad business on television because you put them in under an inordinate amount of pressure. You put them on one night a week. You pay them heavy money. And they almost have to justify their position by coming out with something, even if it is inane, which it often is.
And that's football you're referring to, presumably.
Well, and also baseball. Also the Monday night baseball games. Yeah, I just don't see. And, of course, the rationale that ABC comes up with is, well, look at the ratings. And my answer to that is, well, if you like football, it's the only game in town, as Damon Runyon used to say. And so, what else is new?
We'll get back to our guest, Ken Coleman, right after this.
This time of year is full of financial hurdles, including bills, federal income tax, and keeping up with spiraling winter fuel costs. A well-deserved spring vacation would be great, but you just can't work it into your budget. Luckily, there's help right around the corner. The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank will be delighted to chat with you. Their loan officers can help you arrange for a personal loan just when you need one the most. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings has two, one at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell or at the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Members FDIC. Once again, your host, Dick Bertel.
Ken, before you leave, I've got to ask you, do you enjoy baseball to football? Do you enjoy them both?
I really and truly, Dick, have to say, and I used to have the feeling years ago, but I've been around too long now to let it bother me. I used to think that people would think I was on the fence when I was saying this or trying to hedge my way through it. But the truth of the matter is that I really do enjoy them all. In their own seasons. Now that, I've had baseball seasons when I've been around teams that have been in, seventh or eighth place in August, and then it gets to be work and tough work. But I enjoy them, and I also, might add that I enjoy very much, the college basketball that I've had the chance to do the last 2 years here in Connecticut. The University of Connecticut, we did the tournament here at Hartford. We did a number of teams, UConn and Fairfield for the most part, but a lot of teams around the state. And I think that's a great scene. I really enjoy it very much.
Ken Coleman, thank you very much for being our guest on the Golden Age of Radio. The book is called So You Want to Be a Sportscaster, published by Hawthorne. If you want to be a sportscaster, get a copy of the book. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Let a song be your style, you stitch shampoo.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sherago and Dick Bertel.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and Lillian.